Welcome to New Realities. That was a song called The Crime of the Century by Duke Williams. But we really are going to talk about something like The Crime of the Century tonight with the guest Sidney Kirkpatrick and his book Hitler's Holy Relics. Sidney, thanks for being here tonight.
It's a pleasure to join you, Alan.
I heard you recently on Coast to Coast in a really informative interview and talking about the book. And the idea is that Hitler stole these relics from the museum in Austria, the crown of the Holy Roman Empire and the Spear of Destiny, and took them to Nuremberg, where he had them hidden. And eventually, you know, towards the end of the war, it seemed like, the Germans were losing and they wanted to hide these things someplace else. Is that true? I mean, is that where?
Yeah. Generally, what I've written is a true crime World War II story. You know, we know, and much has been written about, of course, you know, Hitler plundering the great art treasures of Europe. What we haven't really known is the degree to which, you know, Hitler and his high priest Heinrich Himmler were interested in mysticism. And one of the treasures that they went after was a collection called the Crown Jewels of the Holy Roman Empire. You know, one of the relics in that collection was, you know, the Spear of Destiny, which of course is featured in a lot of Indiana Jones movies and comics and a lot of pulp fiction, you know, for many years. With this book, you know, I think we get the real story.
Well, just for people who don't know what the Spear of Destiny is, it's the spear that supposedly pierced the side of Jesus, and the blood that spewed out healed this Roman soldier, and he became a converted follower of Jesus, and that spear has somehow stayed around for 2,000 years as a relic of power. Really, would you say that?
Absolutely, as a symbol of power, there was a great deal of mythos about it. But you know, to be specific, as legend has it, as it's told in, you know, the Christian Apocrypha and Eastern Orthodox tradition, Longinus was a Roman centurion who was going blind. He had cataracts. And Pilate pulled him out of the ranks because he was no use any longer on the battlefield and assigned him to Mount Calvary. And his specific assignment that night, the night of the crucifixion, was to make sure all the bodies were off the crosses. You couldn't have a body hanging on a cross at Sabbath, at sunset. And so he and you know, his assistants first broke the legs of the two thieves, which were said to have been martyred or crucified next to Jesus. And when they came to Jesus, depending upon, you know, which account you believe, some say he was still alive. Longinus speared him, you know, on his right side, and according to tradition, blood dripped down the side of the spear and into Longinus's eyes, and he was miraculously healed and had a vision of the future, a vision of Jesus as the Messiah. What was so important to this in terms of the entire sort of Christ story is that this fulfilled Old Testament prophecy, one that the Messiah's bones would not be broken. And
why is that so important? No, I'm just curious why, and that was a part that I did read in the Gospels, that Jesus didn't want his legs to be broken. Now, why is that so important mystically or, you know, spiritually, do you think? Why was that a key?
That the body was to remain pure. It was not to be broken. And so that, you know, was part of the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. The other fulfillment was that, as it is in the Bible, that Jesus, he would be proclaimed the Messiah, and essentially that it was a Gentile that would be doing that, and of course it was Longinus, the Roman centurion, one could look at it, of course theologians, you know, argue these points back and forth, but one could look at it was that Longinus was the last of Jesus's miraculous healings, and also that Longinus, a Gentile, a Roman, a soldier, was the very first Christian, because Jesus wasn't the Messiah until he was pierced in the chest like that. And, you know, Longinus was the first there, so hence he was the first Christian. And because Longinus was a Roman citizen and not a Jew, he was free to travel Roman roads. And, you know, went to Antioch, and eventually traveled up around the edges of the Mediterranean and was eventually martyred. And he carried with him that spear, proclaiming, you know, as a display item, and said, you know, here, look at this. This is the spear that, you know, I pierced the Messiah with.
And how did the
spear took on a real mystical importance. And many emperors lusted after it, fought over it, and unlike other holy relics, let's say like the Shroud of Turin, this was, you know, this spear was not property of the church; it was property of the emperor, of the world monarch who possessed it. And as it was passed on through history, became part of the coronation ceremony. That if you really wanted to be a Holy Roman Emperor, you needed to have the spear, along with other accoutrements that were eventually added to it, the crown, the scepter, the golden orb, which was like a golden apple with a cross on it, which signified world Christian rulership. And so these eventually became a collection, you know, over a period of 700, 800 years, which are called the crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire. And
right.
What makes this story so very interesting is that, you know, we know all about Adolf Hitler's, you know, rise to power and of course, you know, the rise of the Third Reich, their activities during World War II. But Adolf Hitler, as a young art student, had actually seen this relic. You know, he was, in 1909, he was 20 years old, was a failed art student, at points in Vienna, in his life in Vienna, he was literally sleeping on park benches. And as the story is told, you know, he ran into the Hofburg Museum, which is the sort of royal treasury, to get out of the rain. And, while he was wandering, through the museum, he went to room 11, and, you know, there in a display case was the Holy Lance and the other crown jewels. And so he started reading the legend about this, and it resonated with him. Depending upon which accounts you believe, he actually fell into a state of ecstasy, had a trance over it. You know, I certainly can't speak with authority on that subject, but it certainly meant a lot to him, and it was very important to him. And years later, as he, you know, in 1933, when he became, you know, chancellor, he tried to set up museum exchanges so that Germany could borrow the spear and put it on display briefly at the museum. But the Austrians, you know, didn't trust him. They knew they wouldn't get it back if they lent it to Germany. And so he took it by force. And it's interesting in many respects. I hate to sort of go on here, but I just find this whole subject so interesting. In the whole plethora of Nazi plunder, you know, I mean, he took Michelangelo's, Renoir's, Da Vinci's, you know, they went through the Louvre. The very first treasures that the Nazis took were the crown jewels. And they took them, you know, May 15th, 1938, and then on May 15th is St. Longinus Day. So these were the very first treasures he took. And he took it, you know, on the very day that Catholics venerate, you know, St. Longinus.
Wait, so let's get back to the Longinus spear, because the whole idea of holy relics is that they do emanate an energy, and I, you know, personally think they do. I mean, on the Coast to Coast show, you said it was more like a mantelpiece, or it was implied that it was just for show of power, but I think Hitler probably really believed that it truly was power and energy that the spear and maybe the crown, but particularly the spear, gives people. And I think it may very well be an energetic transfer of some kind. I mean, what's your opinion about that on a spiritual level?
Oh, absolutely. I feel like it's charged with energy. And, you know, one can debate whether the spear that Hitler got a hold of, this, you know, the spear that, that Napoleon lusted after but didn't get, one can argue that maybe it wasn't the actual spear that was at the crucifixion. I tend to believe that it was, but regardless of that, this was the spear that was venerated, that was prayed over, you know, for some 2,000 years. I think there's a lot of energy. There's certainly a lot of spiritual energy invested in it. You know, you may be familiar with the book that was written by Trevor Ravenscroft called The Spear of Destiny.
Right.
You know, he went into that subject very nicely. Unfortunately, he didn't have the military records available to him because they were classified. He couldn't get a hold of them. So there are a lot of errors in that book. But what it did, I think, is bring to public attention not only the long venerated history of the Holy Lance, but aspects of Nazi mysticism that have not been really discussed, and it's only been in the last decade or so where authors, writers are willing to really look long and hard and sort of reevaluate the nature of Nazi mysticism. You know, if you look at my father's generation, my father fought in World War II, my grandfather fought in World War II. This was not a subject they discussed. I mean, if you'd asked my grandfather about it, he would just not have said. Hitler was certainly not a Christian. He was a pagan. They would have just dismissed it out of hand.
The swastika itself was a mystical sign. I mean,
these people, Hitler, just a
as you say, wanted to kind of merge the kind of political, spiritual, religious sense of the Third Reich as a holy order on earth, in a sense, right?
Yeah, you know, I certainly. You know, I use the term a holy Reich, but certainly no God-fearing Christian would want to, you know, use those two words together. But I think that's certainly what Hitler was envisioning. And, you know, going back to the sort of reevaluation of what people know about Nazi mysticism, one of the things that was so remarkable to me as I started getting into the subject and researching it was, you know, the Nazis wrote their own Bible. You know, they revised the New Testament. They got rid of the Old Testament because it was Jewish, and they tried to pull Judaism out of the Bible. But they actually believed, they actually wrote a Bible which, you know, had they been successful, you know, had they, you know, successfully wiped out the Soviet Union and, you know, taken control, might have been, you know, the Bible that was used. They were building a national cathedral. You know, a lot of people, they just don't realize the degree to which the Nazis and certainly Hitler and Himmler were informed, you know, by Christian tradition and Christian ethos. You know, of course, this is not to in any way support, you know, that regime. But I think people tend to overlook the fact that, you know, I mean, Mein Kampf was edited by a Jesuit priest.
Mm. It would be interesting to see what that Nazi Bible actually read like. Was it destroyed completely? Not that. I mean, it would just be a kind of a weird study of religion, I think, to look at the Nazi Bible. Has anyone read that? Is it around?
One can get it. You know, it's not widely distributed, of course.
No, of course, it would be a little weird.
Yeah, the Nazis, you know, were creating what they viewed as a Holy Reich and complete within Aryan Jesus. I mean, and this is where, you know, Longinus figures into the story so far, because you have, you know, Longinus, an Aryan. That's how the Germans thought of him, as an Aryan, because he was a Roman from Gaul. And that it was, you know, that the first Christian, many Nazis believed, you know, Longinus was the founder of Christianity, that he brought Christianity to the West, that a soldier, Longinus, in spearing Jesus, had killed the king of the Jews. You know,
On the subject of Nazi mysticism, it's something that I was told that somehow the Tibetans were involved in taking the suffering that was happening in the concentration camps and turning that into a sort of power. Is there any truth to that level of Nazi mysticism? I know it's off the subject of your book. Have you heard that, about the involvement of the Tibetans at all? Or is that?
Well, yes, certainly. Certainly that was a part of it. You know, in Hitler's Holy Relics, I specifically get into a group who were known as the Annenerbe. And this was a Nazi think tank of soldier scholars. If you were a doctoral student, if you were a historian in Nazi Germany, and you wanted to avoid, you know, going into the armed forces, you could join the Annenerbe. And you know, this is the group that went around the world, that sent, you know, scholars to Tibet, that sent, you know, and a whole team of scholars went to Jerusalem looking for evidence to try and prove that Jesus was of Aryan descent. I know it's sort of mind-boggling, but literally they had teams sent all around the world. This is, you know, what Steven Spielberg, you know, drew on for his Indiana Jones series. And,
right,
you know,
the Nazis were looking for the art.
There really were elements of truth to that whole thing.
Right. So what was the story with the Tibetans and the allegiance with the Nazis? Not you know, I mean, Tibetan, it's a whole different place now.
Of course, you know, at the very base of Nazi ideology was the belief that Aryan man represented high culture, that ancient Aryan man possessed psychic abilities, language abilities, were a sort of superhuman, a race of superhuman people, and that they had become polluted over the centuries, over the millennia, through intermarriage and a whole score of things. And so the Annenerbe and these group of scholars were going around the earth searching for evidence of where Aryan man had traveled, the runes, R-U-N-E-S, I'm sure you've heard of these, which are sort of Nordic scratchings, Nordic symbols, which have been found on rocks and mosaics, evidence of what the Nazis believed was Aryan man. And they believed that Aryan man had settled in Tibet. and they were doing all kinds of anthropological studies to try to prove that. And the mystical beliefs that grew up in Tibet were of Aryan, roots.
But was there something about turning suffering into power? Is that part of the legend true? Have you heard that?
Well, I've heard it, and I certainly I can't say that that I understand it. But certainly, through suffering comes purity.
Was that their thinking with monks doing that for the Nazis? I'm just curious because I never was able to confirm that legend.
It's a very frightening thought, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. But who knows? But getting back to this idea of the Nazi mysticism, in a sense, Hitler became a sort of religious cult figure. He was the leader of the people. He was this messiah, this dark messiah in his own way. And so,
and of course, Nuremberg, which figures very prominently in my book, it's the backdrop of the whole story. It's where the crime story takes place. Nuremberg had a very, very ancient, long history with these relics in particular, and the Spear of Destiny was displayed in Nuremberg for some 750 years. It was there where cults grew up around the spear, where the spear itself was made part of the communion ceremony, the chalice was filled with wine, and then the spear was dipped into the chalice with wine and became the blood. Some churches in Germany and in Europe still practice that ceremony. Really fascinating things to me, very convincing, and it was certainly very convincing to the German people. I don't know if you're aware of the German mystic Anna Catherine Emmerich.
No, I'm not.
She was very much like a Hildegard von Bingham in the 1800s in a nunnery in Germany. And she was a famous stigmatist, where wounds opened up on her hands and on her feet, corresponding, of course, to the crucifixion, and would fall into states of ecstasy. You would know her work in Mel Gibson's movie Passion of Christ.
Right.
The Passion story that Mel Gibson tells in that movie is directly from the ecstasies of Anna Catherine Emmerich.
Oh, I see. Okay, so what was her connection with the spear?
She figures very prominently in the history of the spear because one of her talents as a mystic was if you handed her an object, she could psychically or spiritually, depending on how you look at it, tell you where that object had been, who had used it. And they, various rulers, in her time would present her with things and want to know its origin, and she was invariably right. And they tried to trick her, many times, but she kept with it. And at one point, they brought the Holy Lance, which was in Nuremberg, into the nunnery and handed it to her. And she, trembled, fell down, and laid out, and went into a state of ecstasy, and a wound opened up on her side, and she started bleeding. And this was, witnessed by many people and was dutifully recorded. But it sort of added to the mystery, to the mysticism of this lance, that this was, even in Martin Luther's day, when the great cathedrals were being ransacked, the spear was still held out as a holy object.
Well, so if this spear was that powerful, and maybe it did give Hitler the power that he had to sweep through Europe. I mean, there's lots of questions that come up. Is there any morality on the side of relics to do good, or is it just like you got the power, you go with? I mean, I don't know if these are questions that can really be answered. Of course, ultimately, it didn't win out, but we can just hypothesize and think, did it give Hitler power? I mean, I think it may have. Maybe indiscriminate.
Well, you know, it certainly did in several respects. One, because these relics were venerated so much that they were held by, you know, world monarchs, that Hitler was the next claimant. I mean, you've got to realize, the first major claimant to this spear was Emperor Constantine.
And, in 300 you know, AD,
who was the
you
first,
mean, back then.
Christian, Roman emperor. And Constantine was said to have carried this spear at both councils of Nicaea, which were, you know, the councils where the books, where the Bible actually came into being, you know, where the various Christian texts were decided. And so, you know, it was carried there. After that, you know, it was past Emperor Theodosius, it went to, Emperor Otto, Frederick Barbarossa, Napoleon lusted after these, you know, after the spear and after the crown jewels, which were in Nuremberg, and you know, sent an army to try and get them, and the city fathers in Nuremberg secreted them out of Nuremberg into hiding and brought them to Vienna.
And that's where they ended up in Vienna, because of Napoleon.
Right, and and because with Napoleon came the end of the Holy Roman Empire. When the empire collapsed, and Nuremberg, the city of Nuremberg, which an emperor had, you know, willed these things to Nuremberg for eternity, when the Holy Roman Empire collapsed and Nuremberg asked for these treasures back, you know, the Austrians said, well, these are the property of the Holy Roman Empire. Holy Roman Empire doesn't exist. We're going to keep them. And so they ended up, you know, in Vienna. But
and they're actually in Vienna,
you know,
today. I mean, did you go to Vienna researching and look at the Spear of Destiny?
Sorry, I missed that.
I said, have you been to Vienna, to the Habsburg Museum, to look yourself at the Spear of Destiny that's back there?
Oh, absolutely. This was really one of the most fascinating research trips. Researching this story, you know, Hitler's Holy Relics, was just really one of the most fascinating, bizarre adventures of my life. We started in underground Nuremberg, where this secret bunker that Heinrich Himmler built to store these things, and the bunker's still there. I mean, you can't go to Berlin and visit the Hitler bunker, but you can visit the Himmler bunker. And,
Actually, I was in Nuremberg.
Poking around underground was just absolutely fascinating. Visiting Heinrich Himmler's castle, you know, which is still standing. You don't find it on tourist maps.
I visited that castle. I was in Nuremberg just kind of hitchhiking through about 20 years ago, and there was this really creepy castle. And I heard you say it was a youth hostel. I think I stayed in that youth hostel, and it is a really weird place, isn't it? Creepy.
Oh, it is. Well, I mean, the German government really doesn't know what to do with this castle, because it's a historical monument. I mean, it was important to the history of Germany long before Heinrich Himmler took it over, and then Himmler took it over, and so the German government doesn't want to turn it into a tourist attraction, you know, for neo-Nazis, but at the same time, they can't tear it down, so they don't quite know what to do with it, and it's still there, and many of, some of the Himmler's things are still in it. And it's a youth hostel. So, you know, it's a very creepy place to visit.
I stayed in that youth hostel, and it was odd. I mean, I didn't know any of this story, and none of it was actually, you know, written up on a tourist plaque. It was just
it's not. I mean, the advantage I had in going into this book was, I mean, just to take a step back, you know, was the oral memoirs of a World War II soldier who happened to be, you know, German-born, German-educated, Walter Horn, got his doctoral degree in 1933 just as Hitler had come to power, and his art history professor, his mentor, you know, was saying, you got to get the hell out of Germany. This, you know, the real trouble's on its way. And Walter was reluctant to pull up stakes, one, because his whole family was in Germany. Another reason is because his specialty was Germanic holy relics, was medieval history. And third, he was having an affair with this Jewish girl who was married, happened to be married to a Nazi, and she thought she was protected by virtue of her marriage, but of course she wasn't. And so he dragged his feet too long, eventually got into trouble with the SS, fled to Italy, got to Cuba, got to Greenwich Village, and eventually got a job teaching at UC Berkeley, and he married, you know, the first student, the first girl who came into his classroom, got his U.S. citizenship, breathed a sigh of relief, and then, you know, bang, World War, you know, Pearl Harbor, we're in the war, and he finds himself headed back to Germany to fight the Nazis.
Well, how old was he when he got to Berkeley,
which is
though?
Really where the book begins.
How old was he when he got to Berkeley? I'm just curious, because he seemed like he'd been around a while to be drafted.
Yeah, well, you know, he was in his 30s.
Oh, he was in his 30s. And then he gets drafted. He ends up in Germany. Then he is interviewing someone in Hitler's army who's kept his relics secret.
He's fighting with General Patton, and Patton's just ready to make the jump across the Rhine, you know, into Germany. And Patton's really concerned, for good reason, that the Nazis are going to use chemical or biological weapons when they cross into the fatherland. And so they've captured these prisoners from Battle of the Bulge, and Patton wants all his German speakers out there interrogating these guys to see what they know about chemical biological weapons. And of course, Walter is one of the first brought out there because he's born and raised in Germany. And, you know, he's interviewing these people and he's not getting any information about chemical weapons. And here's this, you know, 50-some-odd-year-old private who's brought to him to interrogate. The guy doesn't know anything. But Walter, you know, felt really bad for him, sad for him, because, you know, could have been his own father. And, you know, he offers him a cigarette and a cup of coffee, and they're out chatting. And he says, well, I'm sorry, I can't tell you anything about, you know, what you're looking for here. But if you're at all interested in art history, you know, or holy relics, I do have a story to tell. And there probably wasn't anybody in the entire U.S. Third Army. I mean, the synchronicity of this is just incredible. And there probably wasn't anybody in the entire U.S. Army better suited to hear what this, you know, Private Huber had to say.
Why would a private know about the holy relics of Hitler, you know, Hitler's...
Yeah, well, good question. This private's father was an air conditioning specialist, and Heinrich Himmler had hired the father to build a ventilation unit, a special air conditioning ventilation unit in a secret bunker that was buried deep underneath Nuremberg Castle. And the specifications, you know, given the father was that the vault chamber had to be kept at a certain temperature, certain humidity, and once a week, Private Huber's mother was picked up by the SS and brought into this vault to make sure that these treasures were being adequately taken care of, that there wasn't mold or insect damage or anything on these things. I mean, Himmler's poured a great deal, a small fortune, into building this secret bunker. And, you know, it had showers, you know, oil tanks. I mean, it was totally a self-contained unit. You could have survived in that bunker for at least 6 months without having to go out.
And that's where these relics were kept. The crown of the Holy Roman Empire and the Spear of Longinus were kept there throughout the whole war from the time Hitler seized it in what year, 38?
Well, Hitler seized it in 38, and they brought him for display in Nuremberg, and there was actually going to be a great Nazi party rally held for them, but then the bombing mission started. And so these things had to be protected, and Himmler, you know, didn't want his, you know, his holy spear, his talisman, you know, taken from him. The irony, and this is, you know, just this, you know, truth is so full of synchronicities when you really get into it and you start studying the truth behind these stories, and they're so much better than fiction. Okay, so you have, you know, this one German-born U.S. Army captain who really knows, lieutenant, who really knows about these holy relics, who's being told this story. And he goes back to his tent that night, and he types up an art history paper. I mean, it's technically it's an intelligence paper, but, you know, this guy's an art historian. I mean, he teaches art history at Berkeley. He got his doctorate in art history. And so, you know, he writes this 30 or 40 page, you know, what might appear in some scholarly journal, and he sends it on to Third Army Intelligence in Paris, thinking that it's going to be dismissed as some, you know, in some slush pile of useless information. And lo and behold, and, you know, totally by surprise, it works its way up the ranks to Patton himself. And Patton himself believes in Longinus. Patton himself had written about Longinus.
Wait, let me just back up.
He is obsessed as Himmler was.
Wait, so Walter Horn writes up the idea that these relics are still underground under the Nuremberg Castle.
Yeah.
Why would he think it would just be filed away? I mean, it seems like a very amazing find.
Because these were art treasures. And certainly a military man would not have viewed sending a commando team into Nuremberg to secure art treasures. They were fighting a war. They were worried about chemical, biological weapons. This was almost a psychological weapon, possession of these relics. And there were very few people who even understood what these relics were. And here you had this captured German prisoner telling, Lieutenant Horn this story. It's probably the only person in the army who understood it.
But where did Horn encounter Huber? I know it's in the book, but what city was that in?
It was at a prisoner of war camp in Belgium called Camp Namur, N-A-M-U-R. It was a very, this is where the book opens. It's a very trying time for Horn, because here he is, he fled Nazi Germany only to find himself in the military marching back into Germany. Overhead, I mean, the Luftwaffe has been virtually destroyed. You know, the German planes are nowhere in sight. And you have these bombers, squadrons, you know, 700-800 planes at a time flying overhead.
Allied bombs or German bombs?
War camp. And he's seeing these bombers, and he doesn't know when one of these bombs is going to drop on his family's home in Heidelberg. He doesn't know when he looks in these prisoner cages if he's going to see his own brother or his brother-in-law. So he's got very mixed feelings about all of this. So Patton reads this art history paper that Horn has written. It's virtually an art history paper. And so he's the guy who's assigned to go into Nuremberg to secure these treasures.
And I know that's the story of the book, because as the Allied army advances, those treasures are taken out, at least the crown jewels, except the spear is left behind. And you go into various reasons why they didn't take the spear. I mean, mainly it seems like if it was that spear of destiny, it would have prevented the Allies from getting that far anyway. I mean,
the what ifs, what would have happened. But, you know, there were all of these curious synchronicities taking place. I mean, the only way Walter Horn was able to solve this mystery was to go in and talk to the colleagues, these fellow students he had had back in Germany, those who had stayed behind. And, you know, if Walter had chosen to stay behind, I mean, he had all the credentials to have risen very high up in the SS. I mean, he had his doctorate, he was smart, he spoke five languages, specialty was, you know, pre-Christianity, German mysticism, I mean, you know, medieval history. He was a javelin thrower, you know, a possible contender for the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. I mean, he had all the makings, you know, and, you know, you could trace his ancestry back five generations.
So Horn goes undercover.
He
talks to his old art history colleagues in order to understand where that treasure is. Does Horn himself ever get to hold the treasures or make contact with
them? Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, he goes in and opens this bunker. And, you know, there are items missing from it. And so he has to figure out, I mean, the real challenge is, you know, who took them? Where did they go? Patton is absolutely convinced that, you know, that he's worried that there is a the makings of a Fourth Reich, that Himmler's people have... you know, have secret agents, neo-Nazi movement in place, and that they have taken, stolen these relics to use as symbols of a Fourth Reich. And so Eisenhower, too, is, you know, they're very concerned. And so, you know, here Walter, you know, is sent around to recover these treasures. And in the course of recovering those treasures, he gets a picture window, and hopefully the reader does too, a picture window into Nazi mysticism.
Right, and the core of that mysticism wasn't just a symbolic thing, it was a true belief that, like we said before, that there was power in these relics, and there probably is, in a sense, right? I mean,
I believe there is, and certainly, you know, as you know, I wrote a biography of Edgar Cayce, the great psychic, who spoke at length about how seemingly inanimate objects possess a record of history. Where they've been, what they've been, and you know, if people are praying over a particular object, it takes on energy, and certainly the Holy Land, certainly these relics of any certainly took on that power, and so we know. We know Hitler liked this, I guess you'd say venerate, but he wanted these. He wanted this power. And stories are just even now coming out. Just a couple weeks ago, New York Times ran a story of the Shroud of Turin.
Right.
Essentially,
I was
going
to say I went to the church in Turin where the shroud is kept and had a very uplifting, powerful experience. I didn't see the shroud, but I saw the bath or the it was like a casket in a sense where the shroud was kept, and I felt a very high, powerful energy emanating from the place of the shroud. So I think you get someone like Jesus who is connected to the divine and they emanate a higher frequency of energy that could infuse objects with that divine power. I mean, there's the tooth of Buddha in Sri Lanka that people venerate and people have mystical experiences around that. I mean, relics, I think are part of the mystical history of the planet that give people energy and they give good people energy and not so good people energy, I think, you know. So, but getting back to Walter Horn, the guy who told you the story, he eventually solved the mystery, and that's what you go through in the book, of where all these artifacts were, or these relics.
And so, you know, he was sent on a mission, and, you know, which, you know, became sort of the post-World War II, the occupation experience, to try to recover these artifacts, and eventually did. And made all kinds of fascinating revelations along the way, including, you know, visiting Himmler's castle and going down into the vault chamber. And, you know, you talk about how creepy Himmler's castle is. This vault chamber is, you know, it's a scary place. You know, it was once a medieval, it was a medieval tower, and he had slave laborers dig it out deeper. And there's sort of three sections. And I urge you, if any of, you know, your listeners are going to Germany, you know, pick up a copy of Hitler's Holy Relics, and you can find out where these places are so you can visit them, because they don't show up on tourist maps. But you can go down into this vault, and, they, you know, where the ceremonies were going to take place. And they have these urns and symbols cut into the floor and ceiling.
Well, how do you know they didn't do the ceremonies already in order to reenact
certainly some ceremonies were conducted, and absolutely, there's no question, there's photographs of ceremonies taking place at the castle. The ceremonies involving the lance, I don't know. There's really no photographs of that. And the castle was in the midst of reconstruction as the war was going on, and reconstruction ultimately stopped. One of the real mysteries of this castle was why Himmler needed 4,000 slave laborers to renovate his castle, which is, it's not actually all that large a castle. I mean, it's like a size
dig the tunnels that hid the or something like that, right? I mean, they did.
Well, I mean, what the real revelation is that he was reconfiguring the castle and the special north tower into the shape of the Spear of Destiny. With study centers, monks' study centers, and outbuildings and a lake, and this was one of the most creepy, scariest revelations of all, is that they didn't just talk about this; they believed it, and it's a frightening thing.
They not only believed it, but I think it was like black magic. They were accessing a level of power that they were able to use and manipulate. I mean, it goes beyond belief. It's an actual, you know, I think those things exist. They're not nice things, and you people do all sorts of things with those. I mean, I think that's a possibility anyway.
Absolutely, yes. Oh.
And I think that if you want to go a little bit more into the Nazi mysticism part, how were they manipulating certain objects to gain power on that mystical level? I mean, do you want to talk about some of that?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, Hitler and Himmler, too, and it's not that I'm sort of pushing Goering aside or Hess or any, you know, Albert Speer or any of the other important Nazis. Right. You know, because they were all part of the same cabal, but Himmler was really obsessed with the mysticism, and the objects that he had looted all had a spiritual element to it. You know, he didn't just go into museums and taking the paintings off the wall. They went after specific objects. They went after the Shroud of Turin. The only reason the Shroud of Turin wasn't taken was that monks in Turin secreted it into out of Turin, into a small parish and hid the item.
But what was Himmler's? But what was his basic belief system about these? I mean, do we know? Did he write? I mean, is there legend? I mean, what did he really believe and want? And what was his drive for these objects?
Well, at its very root, you know, was belief in the power of Aryan man, and that if you could somehow recapture that, you know, invest yourself in that ancient spirit of, you know, Aryan Nordic man, you would have psychic powers, because these were superhuman, you know, a race of superhumans, and you know, that's what Himmler's breeding centers were all about, you know, where they were literally breeding Nordic children. That's what the study center in his castle was all about, and trying to, you know, bring back that strength to conjure it up within an individual.
What tradition? I mean, who would you say, where he learned that from? What was the lineage of Himmler's belief system? Where did it come from? Do you know?
Well, certainly, you know, both for Himmler and Hitler, it was, you know, rooted in Catholicism.
So
certainly, you know, not the anti-Semitism, but the anti-Semitism, of course, was very, very prevalent in Europe at the time. I think, you know, what Hitler was creating his own cult, and that's, of course, what it was. And, you know, only in this case, the, you know, cult became national.
Right.
So it was an amalgam of different beliefs. And, you know, certainly some from Tibet, you know, I mean, certainly the swastika, of course, you know, has a history. It goes back, you know, eons.
It's a sign of power and energy, the swastika, in Asia, anyway, Tibet, yeah. India, it seems. There's also other types of, I'm sure, practices they must have engaged in, rituals that they thought gave them power. Do we know what those could have been at all?
Well, we suspect what they are, and certainly Walter Horn in this book suggests what they might have been, and certainly a bloodletting, you know, very much like spearing the side of Christ, letting your enemy's blood, or, you know, be drenched in that blood. Certainly one of the, you know, in this chamber underneath Himmler's castle were the ashes of the fallen Reich heroes. You know, your ashes would be made part of that. This was where, you know, high-ranking SS officers were given a ring, a specific ring, you know, the death's head ring. This was where that ceremony was given, where you were presented with this ring. You had to do, to actually join the highest ranks of the SS, you had to spend time in this castle, you had to undergo, you know, spiritual teachings as well as, you know, military. So it was all part and parcel of the same thing.
I mean, why do you think that if there is power in these objects, that Hitler didn't end up winning the war? Is it because it was just not a good thing? Or, I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, of course, it's great that he didn't, but he made some big mistakes. But, I mean, if these objects do have power, something could have happened. I mean, what's just your personal opinion about that?
I don't know. You know, I'm very undecided on that point. Certainly, there's, you know, plenty of evidence over the centuries of rulers who had this spear, and it didn't work for them. You know, one couldn't conclusively say that, okay, you get this spear and suddenly you've got the power. Certainly, you know, having that spear as a focus, would certainly be important. you know, it's certainly using it as a link to the past, as a link to, you know, the great rulers of the past. Mm-hmm. Symbolically, of course, it was extremely important.
But when you saw the spear, you went to Vienna to see the spear, researching this book. Did you feel anything emanating from the spear?
No, I didn't.
You didn't. But did
no,
you?
No, I didn't.
Have you with other relics that you may have seen in this, like the Shroud of Turin? Did you feel anything in any of those other?
No, but I've certainly had that feeling before, but not necessarily with as high profile a relic as something like the Lance of Longinus.
Right. Which relic?
You know, I think one can. What's the right word? I guess is resonate. You know,
right.
that I mean, you know, going back to Edgar Casey. You know, Edgar Casey believed that these objects had certainly vibration, and they vibrated at some level which, if you are particularly attuned to it, you can pick up on.
I think it's true. I think there is a resonance with this energy. Of course, you didn't hold the spear. You may have had a vision if you actually touched it or something like that.
That's true. Yeah.
But the crown is also involved, the crown of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, that wasn't a sacred relic. It was just a symbol, really.
It was in the sense that, you know, when the crown was first worn, you know, this was God's appointed guardian on earth.
And when was it first worn, the crown?
Probably around the time of Charlemagne.
Oh, but it wasn't made for Charlemagne. It was pre-Charlemagne.
No, it's hard to give specific dates because the crown itself changed over the years. Things were added to it. Jewels were added to it. I'm sure the first crown was very simple, and it became more ornate, just as the Holy Lance actually underwent many changes. The first images of it, it looks like a regular simple Roman spearhead. At one point in history, it was broken and was mended and wrapped in silver and gold to do the mending, and they added a nail which was alleged to have been, you know, used
in
as
the
crucifixion,
the
and they added that to the spear itself, and a gold sheath was eventually put on it. You know, the spear itself evolved over 2,000 years or 1,000 years, depending upon when you think it, if you think it was the real thing or not.
So getting back to the book with Walter, you met him.
I never met Walter. I met his best friend Felix, who they were very much of a team together. Walter died in 1995, and I actually hadn't set out to write a sort of World War II crime story at all. I was going to write a history of the Spear of Destiny, and. Specifically about how it was venerated differently at different periods in world history. I got to the last section where Hitler was after it, and I knew that that Patton's men had gotten it back, but I really didn't know how or who got it back for them. And so down in the National Archives, I don't know if you've ever been down the archives, but I urge anyone
in Washington,
open to the public. It's in College Park, Maryland, and I went in to National Archives. All you need is your license, and you can hunt through, with the World War II papers, and you know it's the size of a football field. I mean, it's huge,
right.
And so I went specifically looking for answer to that question. Well, how did Patton get this spear? And then I came across. The name of Walter Horn, and I started digging through, and I eventually found his widow, and he had left behind a big trunk of paper on the subject, and I was the fortunate recipient of that. Actually, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis had tried to get Walter to write a book while he was alive, and they had an extensive oral history which was conducted on that, and Walter died before the book could come to fruition, and the project died with her, and then I was a grateful recipient of that. That material.
So you meet Walter Horn's widow, and she has a trunk of his papers documenting his story of finding these relics. Is that
right?
Is that
what? And then as soon as I have those papers, then it's a manhunt for find out who's still around. And one of Walter's great friends, who was instrumental in this, guy named Felix Rosenthal. Who was another expatriate German, a Munich Jew, was still around. And so he helped me through it. And then of course, there were a number of Germans. The World War II generation is leaving us very rapidly. But, thankfully, we're getting their stories down, and this is one hell of a story. It certainly wasn't anything I expected.
You meet Felix, and you have the papers, and Felix describes for you the sort of emotional states that Walter was in throughout the course of this.
Yeah, and that's really why I'm able to write with such detail on this, and I try to tell the story like a... Well, all my books are written... as a drama, but of course it takes years to research these things.
Right. So what did you find, let's say, in Walter Horn's papers that maybe was too much to put into the book, or too way out, or just didn't fit in, but maybe you could share anyway? You know, I mean, was there anything that?
Well, for me, I think the powerful, meaningful stuff was Walter as a human being. I mean, here you have, a man who literally fled Nazi Germany, leaving behind his family, his loved ones, and finding himself turned around with a gun in his hand, marching. Now with the U.S. Army, and it's almost as if divine providence had put this challenge in front of him. All of a sudden, it was like it was dropped on him. Of all of the soldiers in World War II, for him to be told to interrogate the one person that the Allies have who knows the secret location of this bunker. And to tell that to the one person who it would have meaningful to resonate with. I mean, that's a bizarre synchronicity. Felix Rosenthal, it was another bizarre synchronicity. His family had a very well-known painting. They were wealthy Munich antiquarian book dealers.
Uh-huh.
And the Nazis came and seized the family artwork. And one of the paintings was of Jesus on the cross, and four decades later, they find the painting. I mean, it's being repatriated to them, and they get it. The family gets it back, and they open the crate that it's in, and there's the painting with Jesus. Only at some point on his journey, the crate that had been shipped in was damaged, and the side of Jesus the canvas was ripped right there where they were going after, where the spear had gone in. So it was
that's interesting.
Bizarre synchronicities. Yeah,
that is very strange. So you're saying essentially, if Walter Horn never interviewed this private, these treasures probably would have been lost forever, perhaps.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just this almost divine synchronicity going on, and that's really what was almost scary while I was researching this thing. Yeah.
So, I mean, does that kind of show you that perhaps there's a there's maybe a consciousness around these relics to, like, remain? I mean, it's amazing if the Shroud of Turin is the real shroud that covered Jesus, that it still exists after 2,000 years. Is there, I'm just asking, is it possible, and who knows, some kind of intention within these objects that emanate a consciousness that presents something to our time?
Well, I certainly couldn't deny that there is a very strong possibility of that. You know, as we said earlier in our conversation, these relics were not property of the church, unlike almost all other holy relics. You know, these were property of the emperor. I would love it if these objects went on a tour, like the Tutankhamun, you know, treasures.
Yeah.
From Egypt.
Yeah.
I mean, how exciting that would be to have, you know, the crown jewels, the Holy Lance, you know, at the Metropolitan or in Cleveland, you know, or in Los Angeles.
Do you think that's possible? Was that something that people have talked about, or no?
No, but I'm talking about it now because I think they ought to be. I think these things ought to go on an exhibit around the world. I think the more people know about these objects, the more interesting they will find them, and the closer we will get to really getting a grasp on what went on in Nazi Germany, the mysticism, the tools that Hitler used to seize power for a time, what he used to justify, you know, the concentration camps, the horrors.
How did he use that to justify?
These are very relevant things to us today. You know, of course, where you have world leaders.
How did Hitler use these things to justify, you know, the torture and the concentration camps and killing millions of people? How did he use that to do? Yeah, to justify.
Well, because you know, inferior races had to be eliminated because they would pollute, you know, the strength of Aryan man.
And, oh, because he had the divine right, because he owned these objects, he therefore had the will of heaven to be in power. That's what.
Yes, yeah, he believed it. He believed it. I mean, he believed himself. I believe that you know, he thought of himself as, you know, as God's chosen instrument.
Well, he did have a power that obviously hypnotized people in a sense, and moved people to do the most awful of things. He had some kind of power to do that. But, you know, I guess that's, we have to learn from those lessons that, you know, just because people are charismatic doesn't mean we have to listen to what they're saying. And but I wonder if... you know, if those objects are moved around, what they would do, like you're saying, so it would be a positive thing to see these objects by people if they were on tour, because it would.
Oh, I think so. Wouldn't you want to go see them?
I'd love to see it.
Holy Lance was on a world tour. That would be interesting.
Oh. I would love to see it, just to see what kind of energy, you know, I would get off of it. No, it'd be very exciting, for sure. Are you a Christian? What's your background? I'm just curious.
Oh, yes, yeah. I'm certainly a Christian. There's no question about it. But of course, I take a rather broad view of Christianity and spirituality. So, you know, whether you would say I'm a dedicated Episcopalian or not is another question altogether. But, you know, I came sort of while writing this biography of Edgar Cayce, you know, this opened me up to all kinds of things and areas and places I never thought I would go. I was sort of dragged kicking and screaming to investigate the Cayce papers and was just mystified, blown away, you know, by the veracity, by the truth that I found in them. You know, the stories that I thought had been embellished and stuff turned out to be true. And so this opened up to all kinds of things. And over the years, You know, I met psychics and many psychics, and I've seen, you know, some inexplicable phenomena. I don't know if you remember, there's a famous Los Angeles psychic named Peter Hurkos.
Peter Hurkos. No, tell me about him. No.
A painter, a house painter in Holland, and he had during World War II, and he had fallen off a ladder while painting a Nazi army barracks, and fallen onto his head, and suffered a terrible injury. But when he came out of his coma, one of his abilities that he had been given was the ability to hold an object, to put an object in his hand, and he could hold it, and he could tell you where it had been, just like Sister Anna Catherine Emmerich, who we were, you know, the Catholic nun we were talking about earlier, who'd been handed the Spear of Destiny. And Hurkos was good. He was great. And he, I mean, you know, and he wasn't always right. But,
and did you meet him? Was he someone you interviewed?
Well, yeah, I certainly researched his career very thoroughly, and I know his widow, and Stephanie Hurkos. Peter was... you know, I did it in connection with a piece I was writing on the Boston Strangler murders, because Peter Hurkos was one of the psychics who was brought to Boston to handle the scarves that the Strangler used.
And what so did he, was he able to tune in to those scarves as a verification?
Yes. No question about it. And you know, no sooner did he declare what he saw in his vision. I mean, that was, it's one of the, sort of like a blessing and a curse for Hurkos, is because he was able to see things almost like a vision. He couldn't explain why he was seeing what he was seeing, but he'd see these things, and, you know, after holding something, and he would describe it, and he described these murders, and he described the killer. And what he had to say was very shocking and was dismissed out of hand. It was, you know, he had seen a Catholic priest, or a defrocked priest.
And that was the Boston Strangler, a defrocked.
Well, this was dismissed back in the, you know, back in the 60s. But now, through genetic testing, we know for certain, you know, that Albert DeSalvo did not commit those murders.
So they never really found the true Boston Strangler then?
Well, they thought they did, but they thought it was Albert DeSalvo because he confessed. But you know, just in the last decade, we now know he didn't do it. And so you start looking at other suspects, and one of these suspects is you know, someone who Peter Hurkos named. So that was just a piece I wrote, but it was very convincing for me.
So these kind of things opened you up to being a broader kind of view of reality, which is what this show's about, than just, you know, a Christian type of upbringing or orientation. You're saying like what was the thing about Edgar Cayce that really opened you up to the possibility that perhaps he was this great seer and visionary? What was it that convinced you?
Well, you know, actually, as I said earlier, I was dragged kicking and screaming into the Cayce vault by the administrator at my children's school, who was a huge Edgar Cayce fan, and I respected her very much, and she kept giving me all of these books and stuff on Edgar Cayce, and she knew I was a best-selling author, and I, you know, took my work very seriously, and she kept saying, well, you ought to write this book on Cayce, and I could, no, I don't want anything to do with it. And we just, you know, had this tug of war going on, and she kept sticking more and more stuff, Cayce stuff, in my mailbox at school, and I didn't want to insult her, but I finally said, listen, you know, you just can't take this stuff seriously. You know, it's a good story, but that's what all it is a story. And so she challenged me, and synchronicity, we found ourselves in Washington, D.C. at the same time, and so drove down to Virginia Beach, and I was going to go into the vault and show her the error of her ways.
And
for the
what did you find?
That wouldn't prove true, and I couldn't find it. And,
well, what did you find that made you think, hey, this stuff is real?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can go in and sort of enter into the Casey material. The easiest way is certainly through the medical readings, you know, where the many of the treatments, you know, I don't know how much you know about Casey, but he essentially would go into a trance, a self-induced trance, and a physician or anybody could actually put medical questions to him about a particular patient. And he would diagnose illness and recommend a treatment. And he was just invariably correct, you know, and not in these sort of vague, ambiguous terms that you so many psychics speak in, but, I mean, names, dates, locations, blood type, body temperature, I mean, just very, very specific things. And so I went in to sort of see how phony this was, only to discover that it was true. And as soon as you sort of make that leap where, you know, you can't say, you know, how he did what he did, but the fact that he did what he did is sort of incontrovertible, that's, you know, that you start going into dangerous territory. But you know, I ended up spending 7 years writing the book Edgar Casey, an American Prophet. And
yes, and that's a very popular book. But how did that change your fundamental belief about who we are as spiritual beings, let's say?
Oh, well, it just had a profound impact because, I mean, once you become convinced of, you know, that this is actually possible, then you have to ask why and how, and, you know, Casey has answers for those things too, and it's like a picture window into another dimension, and once you step through, you can't walk back.
And, right, so you went through and you haven't come back.
And found impact on how, you know, everything from how I treat my wife and children to how I pick the subject matter for my books. And though Edgar Casey's name is, you know, is not found in Hitler's holy relic, it informs, you know, it helps to inform the writing. And, you know, I mean, I was writing books long before I ever heard about Edgar Casey, but I think I'm writing them in a much more open way and tackling subjects that most mainstream writers won't go anywhere near, certainly most mainstream biographers or nonfiction writers. I mean, you get a lot of writers who will, you know, whip off these books in 6 months, a year, 2 years, something like that. But, you know, I take my work very seriously, and I take years researching and writing a book.
And, so what are you working on now? Can you tell us?
No, can't tell you. But
you are working on something,
you know, all my books are great reads. They're great. I pride myself as a real craftsman, and you know, the reviews on Hitler Holy Relics have been just phenomenal. I'm very pleased. Couldn't be happier.
But is your next book a sort of history in a sense of true nonfiction?
Oh yeah, I only write nonfiction books, and I often write books that could be made into movies. You know, the first book I wrote called A Cast of Killers is about an aging film director, King Vidor, who goes back to solve the murder of one of his friends in Hollywood.
And that's a true story,
know,
too.
The book I wrote after that is about a disillusioned marine biologist who escapes academia to move to this little Caribbean island, thinking that he's going to get away from all of his problems, only to run into a much more serious problem. But I write true stories. You know, archaeologists. Archaeology is certainly another one of my passions.
Is your next book sort of along the mystical lines as well?
Yes, but you know, but they're mainstream books. One doesn't have to be devoted to esoteric subject matter to appreciate them.
Do you ever get into UFOs at all, and any research in that area?
No, not yet.
Because there's a whole huge story going on there, a whole cover-up that I explore a lot on this program, and if you ever do, I think you it would be very interesting for you.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah, well,
yeah. And one final question. Have you looked at relics in other religions? Because India is full of ancient relics from great saints, and people use them as power objects, and the mystical kind of energies coming from them. Have you looked into that at all?
No, I haven't. I would certainly love to, and I'm an inveterate traveler. I mean, I travel constantly, and it would be a fascinating subject to get into. Certainly would be.
Because there was an Indian I met running an ashram that would bury some of these ancient holy relics under the floor of his temple to kind of empower ceremonies there. And I don't know if that makes sense to you, but he would use these as tools for people to have more powerful spiritual experiences.
Yes, I mean... I certainly can understand that, and hopefully, science will come and meet spirituality halfway at some point here in the future, because it would be wonderful if science were dedicated scientists were to actually study these things, because there is something there, and it's undeniable. If you really go in and study it, there is evidence there, but, most mainstream scientists won't go anywhere near it. But
You mean like a scientist would go in and maybe be able to test the field, perhaps the quantum field around these objects to see if there was really an emanation?
Exactly, sure, yeah.
Oh, because next week I'm interviewing this guy, Mark Newkirk, who's very much dealing with fields of energy, light fields, he calls them, and... I wonder if there is a test that could be developed for these things. And in an interview I did with a guy named Hal Puthoff, he would say some of these mystics generated a quantum field. So if they started to levitate, people around them would levitate too, because of this field of energy that seemed to emanate off some of these mystics. So
certainly Hal is a very well respected scientist in his own right, and
yes.
It's delightful that there are scientists like Hal Puthoff who are beginning to explore these things, and I'm certainly convinced that that science and spirituality will, or mysticism, however you want to call it, will come together at some point.
Well, yeah, I mean, people like, Lynn McTaggart, her book, The Field, that's bridging the gap, and Rupert Sheldrake's ideas about morphogenetic fields, they're showing there's a physics to metaphysics, that the two are really not separate, but they're part of a continuum, and often I look at the idea of the field in the sense that we are generating energy that we don't really stop at our physical body, but there's a greater body that we are a part of, and that's a part of us, and that intersects with other people, creating, let's say, psychic fields where we can know the thoughts of others because we are intersecting with a larger part of them. Does that
make sense? Very well said, Alan. That was excellent.
Right, so I think exactly what you're saying, we are coming to a new time of the science of spirituality and mysticism, and I think it's very exciting times.
I'm glad to be a part of it, and it's wonderful that you're such a part of it.
Thank you. I guess we can wrap up here, because the idea is to really read the book, I would encourage people to read the book, and it's in, I guess, every bookstore, Hitler's Holy Relics by Sidney Kirkpatrick, and it's on Amazon as well, and we're looking forward to some other books by you, and also Sidney's the author of Edgar Casey, An American Prophet. What year did that come out?
Around 2000.
Mm-hmm. And your website is SidneyKirkpatrick.com, right?
.com, or, you know, just Hitler's Holy Relics, one word.
Right,
you
and
know,
it's selling,
HitlersHolyRelics.com.
And it's doing pretty well, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's only been out a couple weeks now, and it's done very well. I'm very pleased. The reviews have been excellent, and you know, I'm very proud of this book. I'm proud of not only the material in it, but of how well it reads. It's a fast, fun read.
Do you see it as a movie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, here you have, you know, the real thing of Indiana Jones. You know, the material that it was based on. There's a lot of drama in this story. There's a lot of human drama, and of course, it's the human story which is always the most vital. And here was a perfect vehicle in this expatriate German in which to reveal the larger story.
And you get into his mind in a sense, or project a kind of feeling that you confirmed by people who knew him. But do you sense that you are really, do you really connect with Walter Horn in a kind of spiritual sense? Did you get a real sense of him? I suppose you did, right?
Oh yes, I don't start writing about a character until he's really resonating, or he or she, and I won't start typing on a typewriter or on my keyboard until I'm feeling that about it, until I'm really there with them. And the more objects of theirs that I can surround myself with, the better. I was very very touched. The family gave me his he had a over his fireplace a medieval page from a medieval manuscript of the Holy Lance, which they gave me when they read the book, and I was very pleased to have it and have it hanging with me now.
Well, so do you sense like almost I mean, not just a feeling, but a psychic connection from these people that you're writing about, like a channeling or something like that? Do you have?
Well, you know, I think the truth of the matter is that the best writers always feel that way, whether they'll admit that or not, or whether they'll even open themselves up to admit how closely they're feeling, they're resonating, they're sympathetic, and I mean that in a much generaler term than sympathy.
Right.
I think most good writers do that, and you won't find many who will admit that, or who will say, yeah, I'm channeling this particular person. But I think it happens much more than is generally known.
Well, I think you're right, because obviously you're so into the story, there's a resonance with the person and who we really are, our vibrational resonance. And if we can tune into that, let's say, station that person was, we can start to really, I think, confidently, in a sense, of course we'll never know, pick up on their feelings and thoughts and the dramas of their life.
Well, I think I agree perfectly with what you're saying, but I think there are indications a writer gets when they know they're on the right track, because doors open for them.
Right.
When they catch that vibration, I think, you know, while writing the Casey book, there were so many bizarre synchronicities that you just had to stop and wonder.
Right. Well, I'm writing a book too, and it's about a historic figure, and I get that sense too. It's just for me, do I take the chance in a sense of really being in that person's head and saying, this is what happened? I guess, why not? Who's going to argue with me, right?
Well, you know, you have to dot your I's, you have to conduct, you know, good scholarship, or at least you know, alert the reader to you know, how this information is being drawn. You know,
right.
It's one of the problems with the Trevor Ravenscroft book is that some of this material, he's imagined, and he says this come to him in a dream, and so I certainly can't go there.
No, that's why your books are valuable.
You got to do your heavy lifting, and I'm very proud that I've done. I prize myself. I do that research, and I'm fortunate to have the money, from a publisher's advance to do that kind of research that most people don't get an opportunity to do.
Right. Who published this book? This last book?
Simon and Schuster. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Well, good luck with it. Thank you. I know we've talked a lot, but any final words that you want the reader or someone buying this book to know?
Well, just that it's a very fun read, and at the same time, one gets a picture window into a world that is very rarely seen, and it's only who the protagonist is, this expatriate German, that we really get a picture window into Nazi mysticism that we just haven't gotten. So, you're not going to find a story like this anywhere.
Huh. Well, thank you. It's very exciting, and it just seems like the Nazis just won't go away. I mean, of course, it was a traumatic world time, but I guess there's still lessons to be learned from that part of our history. And maybe the spear of Longinus is back to a kind of empower a new age, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, could be.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks for everything.
Yeah, thank you, Alan, so much. It's a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to following up in the future.
Okay, yeah, maybe we'll do another one. I'll look forward to reading the whole book and let you know how it goes, okay? How I feel.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you're interested in rehearing that interview, you could go to bbsradio.com, look under the archives of New Realities, and also go to my website, newrealities.com. And if you want to reach me, I am at newrealities@earthling.net. Thank you for listening. Next week will be Mark Kirkpatrick and the Light Field Generator. So listen next week, 10 a.m. New York time. Thank you for listening.